This is Valor Radio. Valor, strength of mind and spirit that enables a person to face danger with steel-clad resolve and determination in battle or in any other situation. Valor, like that displayed by veterans of every branch of the military throughout our community. This radio show, Valor Radio, salutes all of you who have raised your right hands to volunteer and protect and preserve our unique American way of life. Thanks for joining us and your brothers and sisters in uniform for Valor Radio. Here are your hosts, Colonel Paul Simonelli and Captain Steve Momano.
Well, hello, folks. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Valor Radio. Steve and I are excited whenever we have an author on, and I'm particularly excited about today. We have Jean McKinney with us to talk about her work called Triumph Over the Taliban, the untold story of U.S. Marines' courageous fight to save Camp Bastion. So, welcome, Jean.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
We thanks for the books, and I think I'm going to start out by saying you mentioned to us and in your bio that you actually never served in the military, and I don't make that as a negative comment. Steve and I were talking right before we went on the air that we were amazed at how well you were able to immerse yourself in it and the detail, the acronyms, everything that without a lifetime in the military, it's hard to believe that you were able to master. Was that a hard thing for you to do, or did that just come as a result of all the prep and reading you did to write the book?
Actually, it's a cumulative effect of what I've been doing for the last 13 years, because that's when I started writing about our active duty military members. That was triggered by an idea I had after Bin Laden was assassinated by the Navy SEALs. Excuse me. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of people out there doing great things wearing the uniform, doing important things, critical things for the security of our country. And why don't we know them? And so I just pitched the idea to a local editor where I live in San Diego, and it just took off. And I've been, so what I've done is I've just jumped into their world for the last 13 years. And that's not just Marines, but Navy, Coast Guard, Air Force, Army, National Guard. I've interviewed active duty in all those service branches. And so I had to kind of jump in their world, be on those training grounds, be on those combat fields, and really understand what it's like to serve our country.
Well, I think Steve and I both agree that you captured it with this book. And I enjoyed the fact that you put a lot of references in there. I like to do my own digging, so it gave me a starting point to look at things. So there's untold number of acts of heroism and valor that we've seen since 9/11, 2001. What made you select this particular incident, engagement at Camp Bastion to write a book about?
Well, I was always looking for a good story as a military journalist, and I've had this addiction, I guess you would almost call it, to tell the stories of the war in Afghanistan, just because not a lot of people are doing it. And so I had interviewed a Cobra pilot, my very first interview 13 years ago. And he said, look, if you really want a good story, you should check out this. And he introduced me to a couple of the people that were there during that battle. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Lightfoot was one of them. And that was way back when. And then when I started hearing about it, and then people would say, well, you should really talk to this person and you should really talk to that person, it just grew into more than a news story. And then when I stumbled on the investigations, it became the whole story. So I dove into all that research. I really wanted to know. I started asking questions. Why were two U.S. Marine Corps generals fired over this? Knowing the Marine Corps and the integrity of the institution like I do, it didn't add up to me. And so I just started looking into it, and then I kind of opened this Pandora's box, so to speak, of information that had never made it out in any of the news stories about what happened to those two generals in the beginning, right after the attack, excuse me.
Well, we're going to hopefully get into a little bit of a discussion about the two generals, because I think that's, I guess, the icing on the cake here. So we'll get to that in a little farther along. So I'll tell you, when I the first time I read the book, I reread it last night, believe it or not. First time I read it, I was stopping. I was looking at some of the references you put in there and other things. But I had some time to think about it. And while it seems that the actions of the Marines on the ground were superb, I have to say, and I don't mean to underplay what they did, but what they did, I expected them to do. I mean, that's been my experience with 30 years. When they get a mission, when something happens, they do what they need to do. And I don't say that to downplay anything and the bravery that they were able to show that night. But I think what this engagement proved to me, that there is something special about Marines.
Paul?
They're all riflemen first, and then whatever their specialty is, second.
Paul?
And yes, go ahead, Steve.
I just wanted to interject. You know, it's an amazing thing how Marines rise to the occasion. I've never known a Marine or a Marine unit that didn't, you know, when the crap hit the fan, they automatically swing into action. And they know that, like, this is their crowded hour. This is why they came in to the service. This is why they became Marines. And I think that's different than any other service. I think every other service, they sit around and loathe the idea that something like this is going to happen. Where Marines, you know, they accept it. They don't like it, but they're in it. And by God, they're going to do something about it. And that's just my sense about the Marine Corps.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Steve. I think the thing that makes the Marines so unique is that every single person that wears the Marine uniform, whether they're a rifleman,
mm-hmm.
a lawyer, you name it, they all have been through the same experience to get to wear the Marine Corps
right.
uniform.
Right. You would never see a cook in the Marine Corps saying, hey, I'm just a cook. No, you're
right.
Not. You are not just a cook. And everybody knows it. So I think you're right about that. I think it's a little different in that service.
It is. No other service comes close to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the services have basic training,
mm-hmm.
but none of the services inculcate
right.
that mentality.
Right. And they take pride in it.
To their members.
They really do take pride in that.
And the other thing is the officers meet and exceed the standards that, once again, whether you're going to be a pilot, no matter what you're going to be, you're going to be a chaplain, you are a rifleman first, and they never forget that. So,
amen.
So, Gene, I didn't mean to just take over the whole conversation there, but Steve and I have known a lot of Marines in our time, and like I said, when you were interviewing these folks, were they matter of fact about it? Were they excited for the actions of other people that they served with? What type of demeanor did you come across, if you could generalize?
Well, let's go back just a little bit to what you said about this is what you would expect Marines to do. And you're right on that aspect. But this battle was different than a pre-planned mission, where they planned for CASVAC evacuations, they planned for contingencies, it's all mapped out before they step outside the wire. This was inside the wire, so that made it different. And those Marines were unsuspecting. They were all over the flight line in all these different areas. And so, and it was night, and it was very, very dark because of this no moon thing. And so when the enemy breached the wire, and that's a whole different part of the story that's in my book, those Marines were doing what Marines do on a flight line. You know, they were getting ready for the next shift. They were, some of them were sleeping, some were eating. You know, some of them were in the cryogenics lab. They were everywhere. And so what makes this battle so remarkable and unique is that they came together. They mobilized, number one, without widespread communications. They were all acting in these little battle spheres all up and down the flight line. And the east side didn't really know what the west side was doing. They were just handling things in their area. And to top it off, at the end, there were no friendly casualties because they didn't know how many Taliban were on the base, how many enemy, how many Taliban were on the base, where they were, what their intent was. They just had to deal with the matter at hand. And so all that training kicked in, like you said. Every Marine is a rifleman. They all spend months going through training, both enlisted and officer. And so all that kicked in. The leadership principles of the Marine Corps kicked in. So that just goes down the line. If one person is taken out of the game, which two were in the beginning of this tragically, then the next in line takes over. And so there's never a time on a battlefield for the Marines without leadership, which is really a unique trait of the Marines as well. So that's what made it different. Now, when I interviewed the Marines that were there, and I was very, very fortunate that they stepped up to do this because it got such a bad rap right after the attack because of this political maneuvering about the generals. And so there was disappointment that their Marines didn't receive recognition for what they did because, honestly, to conduct a counter response on that airfield when there's Marines, think of ants on an anthill, right? There's Marines everywhere. And they're trying to find Taliban who have uniforms on, right? They're in camis. The only thing they could distinguish them by when they finally picked them out with their MVDs is that they had beards and they had on white tennis shoes and things like that.
Tennis
and then
shoes.
Really the way they identified them from the air was tracer fire. I can get into that a little bit. But yes, the Marines I interviewed were gung-ho, very gung-ho. And they were thankful. They were very, very thankful that somebody bothered to tell their story.
Well, I think that's wonderful. In our next segment, I'm hearing some music. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like to set the stage a little bit more and talk about the base and the lack of unity of command to defend the base and the other topics that set the stage that allowed something like this to happen. We'll be back shortly with more of Valor Radio.
Your go-to for standard of specialized business insurance coverage. MGM Associates of Rochester, now serving the region and beyond in New York. Since 1984, MGM has provided leading coverage from a wide range of carriers. Not only home, condo, boat, motorcycle, and auto, but also specialized policies for all types of businesses, including nonprofits and law firms, livery insurance, property insurance, and bonds for all needs. MGM Associates of Rochester provides auto, workers' comp, health care, and liability coverage. Choose from virtual appointments or good old in-office, in-person consults by appointment at our Penfield office. Five-time consecutive winner of the National Best Practices Award, MGM is proud to support veterans groups. For your personal, business, home, or professional insurance needs, meet the experienced staff at MGM Associates. Locally and proudly owned at 1745 Penfield Road in Penfield, 381-7008, or mgminsure.com. An associate of United Frontier Mutual Insurance, 190 Davison Road, Lockport, New York.
Your stuff deserves a better home.
Ow.
all.
That's why you need to store with confidence at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage in Farmington. Units are safe and secure in a variety of sizes. At Hidden Treasures, there are no locks, no keys, no combinations. Bluetooth locks are controlled by your cell phone. Get 50% off your first month. Convenient to everywhere on Loomis Road in Farmington. Close to the thruway. Get peace of mind when you stow your stuff at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage.
Baseball, hot dogs, and the American flag. They're all part of the rich fabric that makes our country great. Show your American spirit by purchasing your flag from the Stars and Stripes Flag Store today. When you do, you are supporting critically needed services for local veterans at the Veterans Outreach Center. Let's show our veterans that we care by placing our nation's symbol on the porch of every house in our community. The Stars and Stripes Flag Store, 783 South Avenue.
From Niagara Falls to the Adirondacks and from Canada to Pennsylvania, you're listening to Valor Radio.
All right, thank you, Bobby. We can always tell who's in the producer seat. Bobby D loves his marching music, and we enjoy it too.
Beautiful.
So we're here with Jean McKinney. And to talk about her book, Triumph Over the Taliban, The Untold Story of U.S. Marines' Courageous Fight to Save Camp Bastion. So we jumped right into the stars of the book, the Marines. But let's set the stage for folks a little bit of what was going on in our country, in the world, and in Afghanistan in 2012. In September of 2012, when this engagement, this battle occurred.
You want me to go?
Sure, go ahead, Jean.
Okay. Well, what was going on at the time is we were starting to withdraw our forces out of Afghanistan. And those forces at Camp Bastion were supposed to be, well, let's put it this way, in the first part of 2012, there were 17,000 Marines in that area at Camp Bastion, and that was supposed to be drawn down to 7,400. So that's a massive reduction. And the issue was they were still fighting out there in the hinterlands. There was still a heavily entrenched insurgency. So there was daily close air support operations. This was an aviation unit, right, an aviation squadron. And they were performing, missions every day. And so, and then they had the dual mission of packing up the base and getting out of town, which is a huge job in itself when you think of every single piece of equipment that has to be shipped back to the United States. They didn't leave that one behind. So that was going on, and as well as the combat role of NATO forces, ISAF, was turning into a support role, and they were going through that transition from a combat role to a support role, and that's no easy thing, and reduced manpower, having the dual mission. And then with an entrenched enemy, when you take away deterrence, they're going to go to town with that. They obviously knew we were leaving, and they weren't leaving though. So there's a gap there.
And to add to that, just to set the stage, in Southwest Afghanistan, where Bastion was, it was a unbelievably busy area, Helmand Province. To give you an example of all the hospitals that the military set up in all the time in Afghanistan, more patients went through the hospital, injured, went through that hospital than any other hospital in Afghanistan, including Kandahar or Bagram. So it just was an unbelievably active place. It was a gigantic base geographically, and so we're not talking about something that you could put a 20-foot fence around and take care of it. there was a lot to defending that place. And the British, during that time period, had primary responsibility for protecting that base, for security of the base. Interestingly, during that same time period, although they say it had no effect on what they were doing to protect the base, the perimeter, Prince Harry was there in his getting his combat stars. And, you know, the question came up, were they so concerned that they put a lot of security around him and left the perimeter uncovered? They say not. But interestingly, when the Brits did their investigation, they called it, and we know the Brits are known for their understatement, they said a high level of complacency on the part of the command, British commanders on the ground. Gene, what can you, any insight that you got from talking to folks of the frustration of the commanders on the ground trying to work with the British?
Absolutely. I just completed a new interview with Major General Greg Studevant. It's not out yet, but he tells the story like it is. You know, back then when they decided to, it's kind of a long, involved thing, but the commanders, both Major General Gurganis and Major General Studevant, both made concerted efforts to improve the security on that eastern airfield, because when they got there, it wasn't up to par for them. And so they saw the red flags. When the British first built the base in 2006, they plopped it down in this remote area of the desert, right? And allegedly they did this so they could have clear vision to spot attackers and fields of fire, right? Well, then Bastion grew massively. And it became not only Camp Bastion, but then Camp Leatherneck for U.S. forces. It was a counterinsurgency hub, the biggest one in Afghanistan at the time. And then it added Camp Shorback, which housed the Afghan forces. And so with that expansion and evidenced by the investigations, the British didn't expand the security that was needed for a base that size. So, and that was evidenced by allowing people to encroach, outsiders to encroach the very edge of the airfield perimeter, by not having enough towers and not a regular manning of the towers, by assuming that the size alone would deter the Taliban from attacking or any enemy from attacking. Because when have Al-Qaeda, Taliban, any of the other insurgencies ever been held back from, you know, attacking U.S. forces that, when we're so much more powerful than them? They don't hold back. They just find a way. And then thinking a chain link fence was impervious was another security gap.
Hey, Paul.
So,
yes.
On top of that, and you can stop me anytime, but I'll just say this quickly. They, our 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing was beholden, the leaders of 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing were beholden to a 2011 memorandum of understanding, which was an agreement that was set forth between British and U.S. forces and assigning areas of responsibility, right? Well, what this does is split the command, and that is not cool in U.S. Marine Corps protocol, because then you're relying on another nation to defend you, right? When they don't have the same protocols. Every nation that is part of a coalition, and coalitions are definitely necessary in security operations like we had in Afghanistan, but every nation has to go by these things called national caveats, which are restrictions or limitations placed on by political decision makers about what their armed forces can do in multinational security operations. pictures.
All right, so I'm hearing some music, so we're going to take a break.
They had theirs, and that wasn't going to mesh together.
We're going to have to take a break here, Gene. We'll be back shortly with more Valor Radio. And Steve, we can pick up with your comment when we get back. We'll be back shortly, folks.
From Niagara Falls to the Adirondacks and from Canada to Pennsylvania, you're listening to Valor Radio.
Back with Valor Radio, here's Colonel Paul Civinelli and Captain Steve Mamano.
Thanks, Robert. So we're here with Gene McKinney, author of Triumph Over the Taliban. Steve, cut you short.
No problem. I just thought maybe it'd be good for us to set the scene on the 12th of September 2012 when this attack occurred. What the base, the Camp Bastion looked like, what it consisted of. I spent a lot of time studying those two photographs that you had in the book, Gene, and they're fascinating, especially for an old targeting guy like me. It's a huge area, the base Camp Bastion. It's 712 square miles, I think you said.
Correct.
Is that okay? And then, but a base that large has a single strand of concertina wire protecting it and a chain link fence that you could just cut through. I mean, it's amazing. And then the 24 fixed concrete guard towers were spaced as well as they could do it, but only 11 of those were manned that night. So what's the point of a guard tower? They made a point of saying at the end, well, now the guard towers are all manned. Well, that's great, but it's like locking the barn door after the horse gets out. One of the things I was frustrated by was you cited the term impregnable, which the British use to describe the base, or at least it was impregnable to them when they built it in 06. But it was anything but impregnable. I think what it does is it gave everybody the false sense of security. Like we had in 1941 before Pearl Harbor was attacked, that the U.S. Navy is ready and willing to take on the Japanese fleet or whatever, and it just gave them a false sense of security, like this is some sort of Gibraltar. And I think that the Taliban knew that we were on our way out, and they saw a window of opportunity and they took it.
They definitely take their windows of opportunity, and they'd been taking it for a while. There had been previous security breaches on that base, and that was not admitted in the narrative after the attack, because when the sole blame was placed on our two generals. But there had been previous security breaches. Both the British and the U.S. Shared a daily intelligence report. But and the concerns Major General Gurganus presented upon his arrival were real and big red flags for the security of his of Third Marine Aircraft Wing.
How did General Amos dismiss that later on? I mean, he had raised those red flags.
I know, and I don't know why. You'll hear from these two generals that they don't know why yet either, because the investigations themselves reveal what the conditions were there.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually talk about the efforts that Major General Gurganus and Major General Sturdivant made to close that gap, that security gap, that threat gap, I mean. Mm-hmm. And that they were denied.
And a lot of the credit that they...
You read the investigation, you go, oh, yeah, they admit that they did these things, but then you get to the end of the investigation, said, but they're to blame.
But and it wasn't... weren't the British actually the ones who credited Gurganus and Sturdivant with doing things to try and mitigate the effect and try to, nip it in the bud at that point?
Well, I just think the British Defense Committee did an amazing job, better job than our investigators.
Isn't that sad, though?
It is so sad. Yeah. It is very sad.
So I'm going to jump in here. We also have to put in context, this wasn't the only large base in Afghanistan or Iraq. We had learned a tremendous number of lessons. You know, as recently as 2010, the Taliban attacked Bagram Air Base, and because of the way the defenses had been established, the unity of command, the commitment of the forces necessary, it had negligible effects, if any, on the operation of the base or the people on that base. There were other incidents in Iraq, same thing. We learned some hard lessons early on, but the models were there. And so what Gurganus and Sturdivant were asking for, they weren't asking for anything above and beyond what had become the standard for protecting a base that included an airfield and, you know, had this much mass. So that, to me, that even makes it worse when I read Amos's letters or the report that he wrote or that someone wrote for him and he signed, slamming these two guys. That being said, there were possibly other things that could have been done. Once again, I think the Brits might have done a great job on their after-action review, but they were complacent, and that was not unusual for the Brits. Working with them a lot of different times over 30 years, that's they do it their way, and they're not always flexible. Remember, the reason they came into this coalition in Afghanistan, the way we coerced them into it, we gave them the lead on drug interdiction. 90% of the heroin that shows up in Europe comes from Afghanistan. And that's how we got the Brits to come along. And, you know, they spent the first 6 or 7 years and accomplished absolutely nothing. There were some very large strategic mistakes that were made between the coalition and all the partners that set the stage. But the Brits did absolutely nothing for the first almost decade, well, half decade, that they took the lead on drug interdiction. So it's just typical British. Now, I agree, their report, they didn't pull any punches, but too little too late in my mind.
I agree with you.
What doesn't make sense either is that immediately after the attack, that the improvements that both our generals put forth were implemented. They got rid of the poppy fields, got rid of them. They manned the towers. They gave Major General Gurganus a unified command. So everything that they wanted before the attack was implemented. And then Major General Gurganus put Major General Sturdivant in charge of security for the airbase.
And Gene, how many times did those guys ask to take out the poppy fields? And how many times were they rebuffed when they tried?
Well, I don't have a number of times. I just have the fact that they did it.
Right.
And I think it was a multiple attempt type thing, but I don't have a number for it.
No, I didn't mean in specific terms, but they had repeatedly asked to do something about the poppy fields, and then they kept on getting the whole, well, we got to wait till after the harvest, you know, or we got to wait till next year or something, you know, and it was clearly on their minds that that was a detriment to defense of the perimeter. I mean, they grew poppy right up to the edge of the perimeter fence.
Yeah, I mean, the Taliban could stand in those poppy fields and watch, you know, aircraft land and take off. They were even shooting at them when they were coming in.
Yeah, that's
landing.
Crazy. That's crazy.
And
so that's one of the overarching issues that set the stage for this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
When we first went into Afghanistan, there was no love loss between the Taliban and the drug lords. If Taliban or Al-Qaeda went on drug lord land, they were in trouble. one of our gigantic strategic errors in Afghanistan is that we lumped all the potential enemies together, and you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And now all of a sudden, the drug lords were letting Taliban, Al Qaeda onto their property, other things that they wouldn't have allowed before. Instead of dividing and conquering the potential enemies in that country, we lumped them all together, and we turned the Taliban into drug-producing entities along with the drug lords. And a lot of other small things that turned into major, set stage for major things like this to happen. Oh, there we go. All right, I'm hearing some music, so we're going to have to take a break here on Valorado. We'll be back shortly with our last segment with Gene McKinney and Triumph Over the Taliban.
Your go-to for standard of specialized business insurance coverage. MGM Associates of Rochester, now serving the region and beyond in New York. Since 1984, MGM has provided leading coverage from a wide range of carriers. Not only home, condo, boat, motorcycle, and auto, but also specialized policies for all types of businesses, including nonprofits and law firms, livery insurance, property insurance, and bonds for all needs. MGM Associates of Rochester provides auto, workers' comp, health care, and liability coverage. Choose from virtual appointments or good old in-office, in-person consults by appointment at our Penfield office. Five-time consecutive winner of the National Best Practices Award, MGM is proud to support veterans groups. For your personal, business, home, or professional insurance needs, meet the experienced staff at MGM Associates. Locally and proudly owned at 1745 Penfield Road in Penfield, 381-7008, or mgminsure.com. An associate of United Frontier Mutual Insurance, 190 Davison Road, Lockport, New York.
Your stuff deserves a better home. That's why you need to store with confidence at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage in Farmington. Units are safe and secure in a variety of sizes. At Hidden Treasures, there are no locks, no keys, no combinations. Bluetooth locks are controlled by your cell phone. Get 50% off your first month. Convenient to everywhere on Loomis Road in Farmington. Close to the thruway. Get peace of mind when you stow your stuff at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage.
Baseball, hot dogs, and the American flag. They're all part of the rich fabric that makes our country great. Show your American spirit by purchasing your flag from the Stars and Stripes Flag Store today. When you do, you are supporting critically needed services for local veterans at the Veterans Outreach Center. Let's show our veterans that we care by placing our nation's symbol on the porch of every house in our community. The Stars and Stripes Flag Store, 783 South Avenue.
You're listening to Valor Radio with Colonel Paul Simonelli.
Back with Valor Radio with Captain Steve and Colonel Paul.
Thanks, Bobby. We were talking about General Amos a little bit before the break. He was Commandant of the Marine Corps. He wrote a career-ending report that ended the careers of two Marine Corps generals. And, you know, you hate to think that personality gets in the way of people doing their duties, but at that senior level of Marine Corps or of any of the services, politics do matter. Some bad things were going on at this time. 3 days before this attack, there was the attack in Benghazi that led to the death of our ambassador and three other folks. And, you know, to maintain power in Washington, sometimes you have to sacrifice others. Amos was known for that. In fact, he had several investigations while he was commandant that he tried to affect the outcome of investigations, you know, applied command pressure. So I don't give much credence to anything I see that he writes or wrote. He lost his credibility in my mind. And while there are things possibly that the two generals on the ground could have done differently, we all know that hindsight is 20/20. Did you get any more insight from the generals when you spoke with them? You said earlier they really didn't understand. It seems like Amos completely ignores much of the facts in making his determination a fault.
Well, these two generals were subject to not knowing why he took that tact. They still don't know. But with the emergence of my book, they know a lot now. They know a lot more than they did, because I have been informing them along the way of what I've discovered. And they took so much heat in the media and so much a wrong blame. And it was so destructive. And that was totally unnecessary. They didn't have to do that. It didn't serve any good purpose. And it was definitely wasn't the truth. It was just a flat out lie that they failed, that the claim that they failed not to secure the base was a lie, because it wasn't just up to one person. It was up to a lot of people. Okay. Every single Marine or every single Brit soldier on that base has an obligation to keep the base secure. Right. So they can't pin that blame on any one person or even two people, especially when they tied their hands. And then they tied their hands and then they slapped their face. So it doesn't make sense. And I don't know why. And they don't know why. But they're not happy about it. And back then it was like, well, we'll take a hit for the team. It's like, you know, they obeyed their commandant's wishes, and they didn't put up a fight, but they didn't really know all the stuff that was going on, you know, and it was a painful time for them.
Oh, I have to believe that it's something that pops into their heads often. I don't know that you ever put it behind you when something like this happens. I mean, the language, I'm just going to read from the Marine Corps' report a couple of lines. The underlying causal factor of the successful Taliban attack on 14, 15 September 2012 was the failure of Major General Gurganus and Major General Sturtevant to adequately ensure that an integrated layered defense in depth was in place to protect U.S. personnel and equipment on the Camp Bastion airfield. And then in the report, they say Major General Sturtevant failed to effectively integrate with such and such on the base, and Major General just failed because he was the overall commander. I guess if you have to point a finger, I'm all for holding folks accountable. But let's make sure that it's grounded in reality and truth. We have another book we're going to be reviewing sometime in the future by a Marine Corps officer called A Few Bad Men, and another person who ended up ultimately banging heads with Amos and was a sacrificial lamb.
I was thinking about that while we were reading this book.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how they did in those other guys. 'Cause,
right.
You know, when something like that happens, the people at the top don't want to accept responsibility. They look for scapegoats. It's tradition, unfortunately.
And, you know, I have a problem with that, because I think that complete denial of what the generals did and were turned down, and it wasn't, they did, even with the turn downs, They implemented changes. They mm-hmm. did things that were under their control, okay? Mm-hmm. They didn't have full control. And so they did as much as they could with their hands tied under their control. And that final accusation was a complete denial of that. And that was wrong.
And it's so unlike
the truth.
It's so unlike the truth.
And then the lies got circulated all over the media, and their pictures are all over the place as failures. And that is wrong.
And the whole process there is just un-Marine-like. You would never see Chessy Puller or Vandergrift or any of the other legendary Marine Corps generals going to extremes to find fault with subordinates. They would figure out a way to accept responsibility and to not indict the others who were on the ground being shot at. They would figure out a way to say, you know, we could have done things better, but there was a lot of heroic involvement here. So they would hold people accountable, but they would do it in such a way and quietly, without publicly humiliating them, frankly.
Right.
Yeah, that was totally uncalled for.
I think so.
And also, you know, the adage, yeah, take a hit for the team.
Right.
And that's kind of what has been tradition to protect the institution. I'm a believer that that doesn't really protect any institution.
No, that's a Navy thing in a lot of ways, Gene. I got to tell you, that's a
don't add up to what really happened, that don't connect to the truth.
Yeah.
And so that is not a good path to follow if the institution is going to survive. And the American people deserve to know the truth.
That's true.
About what really happened. And that's why I wrote this book, to tell them, Gene, the truth of why this happened.
In our last minute or so,
the team, they put the men in charge that were capable of doing the job, and they did the job they were tasked to do with all the limitations that were set upon them.
Without a doubt. So, Gene, in the last minute or so, if you'd like to sum up get people excited about reading your book, Triumph Over the Taliban, we'll be posting it on our Valor Radio Facebook page so people can get a link right to Amazon to get their hands on a copy of it. But I'll give you a minute to sum things up for us.
So those Marines that put their life on the line, and they did at every turn of that battle until that enemy was completely eliminated, that threat was eliminated, they were just, you know, they were doing what Marines do, but this was a very unique situation and one of the hallmark battles of the war in Afghanistan. How many people are writing about these amazing battles? They're all over the place. I'm making a documentary series about the Marines in Sangin in 2010 when Obama had 100,000 U.S. troops over there. I'm just trying. So from 100,000, we drew down to 7,400 in Helmand Province, which was the hotspot during the war. There was just a lot of insurgency because there was a lot of opium, and the opium fueled the insurgency. And they were
out to protect that income. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today to talk about your book, Triumph Over the Taliban. Folks, thanks for listening in. Keep our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coasties, Guardians. Keep them all in your thoughts and in your prayers. And we'll see you next week on Valor Radio.
Yeah, I'm real good on the pressure, being all that I can be. I can't call in sick on Mondays when the weekend's been too strong. I just work straight through the holidays, sometimes all night long. You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door.